Hello. In this audio snippet, we are going to continue talking about Black America and more specifically about the period when the Civil War started. We've been going through the different presidents leading up to the Civil War, and we're basically starting now with the president who was in charge of the White House at the time when the war that ended slavery started. And I mean ended in the sense of officially ending it, because in a way it lingered even after the Civil War, but at least officially slavery ended through the Civil War. And so obviously, that means that we're going to be talking about Lincoln, who was the 16th president of the United States, and he was in the White House from 1861 to 1865. He was reelected, but then he got a bullet in his head at the beginning of his second term and did not finish it. So we are going to start describing what was going on in Lincoln's mind around the time of his election and the people that he surrounded himself with. And it's important to go through this these details to further manifest what Lincoln was really about, that he was not the man that we have made him out to be, or that he pretended to be for the history books, in a sense. So let's go to 2 days before the election, or the inauguration of Lincoln. Lincoln had just been elected, and the southern states started acting out like the end of the world had happened when Lincoln got elected. And we'll talk about that later, their reaction to Lincoln's election, when Lincoln was not a threat to them. He really wasn't, and we'll see why we can safely say that. He was not the threat that they thought him to be, and they reacted as if as if Lincoln was a completely different person to what he really was. But there was a reason for that, and we'll talk about that later, hopefully. So seven states had already seceded from the Union by the time of Lincoln's inauguration. And in fact, six of them, if I'm not mistaken, had already kind of come together officially and elected a president, a new president, Jefferson Davis, in place of Lincoln. So by the time Lincoln was showing up, it's not as if the southern states were thinking, oh, we're going to secede, or if you go into office and act harshly against slavery, we are going to become a separate country. There was already a separate country with a separate president by the time that Lincoln took the stage for his inauguration in 1861. So 2 days before that inauguration, because of what had happened with the southern states seceding and forming a new country, effectively, Congress passed a very little talked about amendment to the Constitution, and it's been called historically as the Corwin Amendment. And it was passed by Congress. In other words, it passed the House and the Senate, and that went to the states to get ratified, because every time an amendment to the Constitution is attempted, it has to pass both houses of Congress, and once it passes, it gets sent to the state legislatures, and it has to be ratified by each state. The minimum to pass as a new amendment in the Constitution officially is 3/4 of the states have to ratify it. And so this amendment was just pending ratification by the states. And if it had passed, it would have become the 13th Amendment. So it would have. This is the other 13th Amendment. The one that became eventually the 13th Amendment was the amendment that ended slavery at the end of the Civil War. So this potential 13th Amendment at the start of the Civil War, or right before the Civil War, you could say, was this Corwin Amendment. And what happened was that there was this, for lack of a better expression, the son of a bitch representative in the House from Ohio named Thomas Corwin. And he introduced the amendment in the House. And in the Senate, it was introduced by William Seward from New York. And we'll talk about that a little bit later about why that is so strange to me. And I still can't quite figure out how William Seward got involved in this. But we'll talk about him a little later. The thing is that Seward introduced it in the Senate and Corwin in the House. So it could have been called at the end the Seward-Corwin Amendment, but historically it's known as the Corwin Amendment. And just to give you a sense of what that amendment was about, 2 days before the inauguration of Lincoln, I will read you verbatim the text of the amendment. This would have been in the Constitution. It would have said, the 13th Amendment would have said, no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state. And if you were listening to the text, I can assure you, you heard correctly. The text was basically saying that it was an amendment saying there shall be no other amendment made to the Constitution that will authorize Congress to curtail slavery. That's basically it. And it's interesting how they dance around the word and say it without saying it. And you know why? Because there was shame in the word. There was shame in it. And everybody knew it. From the top to the bottom, everybody knew there was shame to associate it to the word slavery. So they danced around it and put it in such, you know, legalese terms to make it sound like they were talking about some tax collection bill or something to that effect. So William Seward and Tom Corwin were involved in promoting these this amendment in the Senate and the House respectively, and it passed. And when it went to vote, interestingly enough, it passed in Ohio, Corwin's home state. It passed in Kentucky. It passed in Rhode Island. And to my shame, I guess you could say, because I grew up there, it passed in Maryland. And then it passed in Illinois, Lincoln's home state. And those were the five states, if I'm not mistaken, that approved it. And I don't know if there was any other state, but I think at least those five ratified it. And the other states, most or if not all of the other states who voted on it did not. And that's why it did not pass. It didn't meet the 3/4 minimum. And ironically, part of the reason why it didn't make the 3/4 minimum, or the main reason could be is that many southern states had already seceded. So they did not participate in the voting. So ironically, by them leaving, they lost the chance to vote on it. And had they stayed in the Union to vote in favor of the amendment, who knows, it might have passed. So that's what happened. And this was this last ditch attempt to preserve the Union. And I hate that term. The more I hear it or see it written in the history texts of people saying, you know, during that time, we were trying to preserve the Union. So it was so important to preserve the Union that they were willing to sell the soul of the country and permanently leave the institution of slavery within the fabric of the American society. That's how much they were willing to sell out in order to save the Republic, shall we say. But ironically, if this had succeeded, that would have been the end of America. I can assure you, we would not have lasted much longer than that before collapsing into who knows what the hell this country would have become, and it would have died. We are about to die like 14 to 16 months from now. As I've said repeatedly in these last audio snippets, we are on the verge of America, that dream of America, dying. As I've said before multiple times, the American Republic, founded by the founding fathers, died on the 5th of November 2008. We've had this state of coma that we've been in since then, where we seem to have a semblance of a republic, but we really don't. And that's why all the institutions are collapsing. The presidency is just turned into this assortment of executive orders, and the judicial branch has gone crazy even more, and we have the legislature doing all sorts of weird things. So the American Republic has died, but the dream or the vision of the country fulfilling its purpose is still alive. So there is a chance still of reviving the nation, but not to return to the founding fathers, because there is no going back. It's like the bridge has been burned behind us, and if we try to go back to the past, we're just going to fall into this precipice, because the bridge has been burnt, and all the conservatives are trying to go back to the past. And like little idiots and lemmings, they're just falling off into the abyss because there is no going back. The hope of restoring the nation is not to so that we can go back to a past that is dead, but so that we can move forward to finally go to where we were supposed to go all this time. So we are about to die now, but had this amendment, this Corwin Amendment, passed, we would have died back in 1861. The sad thing is that Lincoln supported the amendment, and he even mentioned it in his inauguration. And literally, I'm going to read literally to you what he said in his inauguration about the amendment, just to give you an idea of what Lincoln was about. He said, quote, "I understand a proposed amendment to the Constitution, which amendment, however, I have not seen, has passed Congress to the effect that the federal government shall never interfere with the domestic institutions of the states, including that of persons held to service. Holding such a provision to now be implied constitutional law, I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable." Unquote. That's what Lincoln said in his inauguration in 1861, right before officially taking office. So he was saying, I hear that there's this amendment, but I haven't seen it myself in detail, but it seems to say that the federal government's not going to interfere with slavery. Yeah, and again, notice the dancing around the word slavery. He said, shall not interfere with the domestic institutions, including that of persons held to service. Persons held to service. Oh, you're talking about like maids or the butlers? All right, is that what you're talking about? And we all know that we're talking about not about butlers, but about slaves. And he said, I have no objection to it being made express and irrevocable. This is what son of a bitch Lincoln said in the inauguration. So all that talk about him being the emancipator and this man that was completely against slavery and fought to help black people be free, that's just a myth. It's just a legend. That's never what he was. From the beginning, he was willing to sell out the souls of black people in order to, quote, preserve the Union. He was embarrassed, ashamed that the history books would write him down as the president whose ascension to the White House led to the breakup of America. That's what he was ashamed of and concerned about. And he was never going to let that happen. And if it meant selling out black people back into slavery, he was willing to do it. He never understood that the moment had come to rise up and say, the hell with this institution, we're going to bring it down. The time has come. We are the generation that we've been waiting for, to quote a son of a bitch bastard who will burn in hell shortly, who stupidly would say that without really understanding what he meant. But in a sense, he... Lincoln was not aware of what was happening, the historical moment that he had been placed in by destiny, by his maker, put in that position for that specific purpose of finally putting an end to slavery. And in the end, he became the agent through whom slavery ended officially, at least, quote unquote. He did so against his will. It was as if he had no choice but to carry out his destiny, and he did it grudgingly. And that's why the son of a bitch got a bullet in his head, deservedly so. And I'm glad he did, as I've said before. So before continuing, let's talk a little bit about Seward, William Seward, who was one of the people who introduced this amendment. Seward is a bit of an intriguing character to me. I still don't get what happened, why he supported this amendment and passed it. He was from New York, and if I'm not mistaken, he actually was governor of New York for a while. And every week, you could say I when I walk in New York, I walk past a statue of him. There's I think it's in Madison Square Park. You know, that part of New York. Right around 23rd Street, and where the Flatiron Building is. Every week I pass by the statue of William Seward. So he was a big figure in New York, and if I'm not mistaken, he was governor of the state of New York, and a very relevant figure in American history, especially during the Civil War time. Just to get a sense of him, in 1850, Seward gave a speech that has been labeled the Higher Law Speech. And in that speech, he said, quote, there's a higher law than the Constitution. And that's why it became known as the Higher Law Speech. So he gave this fiery speech, you could say, that became very well known and controversial, because in it, he said there's a higher law than the Constitution. And that kind of goes exactly to what we were saying in the previous audio snippet. And I did not know about this quote until today, actually. And it's interesting. He was repeating what we said in the audio snippet last week, or you could say that I was repeating what he had said because he historically said it first, but I wasn't aware of what he had said. But that is basically the heart of the matter here. He did not see the Constitution as the sacred document that you have to follow verbatim because it's the 67th book of the Bible, that God wrote this magnificent document called the U.S. Constitution, and we must abide by it because if we don't abide by it and honor it to the hilt, then we are breaking the 11th commandment. He never thought of it like that, the way conservatives do now. And I've said before, I have literally heard conservatives, and I heard one recently, in some documentary that I was watching in passing. I think flipping through the channels, if I'm not mistaken, I don't remember how I landed on that documentary. And this veteran came on and said something like, next to the Bible, the Constitution is the most important document in human history, or something like that. And I went, my goodness, what the hell did he just say? What the hell? But I know that they think that way. It just stuns me every time I hear it. It's as if it is so shocking to me that even though I know that's exactly what they think, every time I hear them say it, it still shocks me. But the Seward fellow did not think like that. And that's how we have to see it. We are to, our rights are not from the Constitution. As we said in the previous audio clip, our rights are not given to us by the Constitution. They are given to us by the truth. The truth, we are born with them. And the Constitution is supposed to just be this secretary taking dictation from the truth, writing down rights that we had before the Constitution ever came into being, if you know what I'm trying to say. So so when it comes to a wrong being done and the Constitution, then you have to, if it's a wrong that violates a human right, one of the five fundamental human rights, and we've explained the five human rights ad nauseum in the past, they're not the human rights of the UN. We are using the same terms, but we're using it finally in their proper and rightful meaning. If there's something that violates one of those five human rights, you have to choose between fighting that violation and defending the Constitution. I will take fighting against the violation every single time. The Constitution does not trump the truth. The Constitution does not trump the rights of the individual. The rights of the individual should trump the Constitution. The Constitution should be beholden to the rights of the individual, not the other way around. And our values, our thinking should all be around that. So if I have to choose between obeying the Constitution and obeying the truth, I will obey the truth. If I have to choose between abiding within the limits, the constitutional limits, and ending an oppression of a human right, I will fight to end the oppression of the human right first and foremost. And as I do that, then I have to point out, hey, what I'm doing is a reflection, is showing that the Constitution is missing something, and we have to address it and confront it straight away. This man understood that we are to live by a higher law than the Constitution. And this statement was sadly enough incendiary in his days, and this was part of his argument that California should be admitted into the Union as a free state. That's, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the context within which this statement was made in 1850. That's when, if I remember, that's when California was admitted into the Union, 11 years before the start of the Civil War. And due to that, so Seward had a great influence in helping California be admitted as a free state. And John Fremont also had an influence, strong influence there, as we briefly explained before, a figure in American history that most people ignore and that I consider to be in the top 20 greatest Americans of all time, even though he never became president or you could say officially carried out duties that would make him famous the way others that have done less have been made famous for. So, even though Seward publicly supported the abolition movement, he was an abolitionist. He was always fighting for abolition. So he was very strongly anti-slavery. And despite that, that public persona, he also had this private persona where his wife, Frances, would use their home as a stop on the Underground Railroad. So he was publicly facing this, you know, scrutiny and criticism by supporting abolition of slavery openly. But then on the other side, privately, he was also risking his political career by helping fugitive slaves in the through the Underground Railroad. And in fact, Seward even wrote a letter on the 18th of November, 1855, to his wife, Frances, saying that, quote, "The Underground Railroad works wonderfully. Two passengers came here last night." So this man was committed to slavery and was risking his political career to help black slaves be free. And in 1858, 8 years after his higher law speech, he made another public address regarding slavery, and that speech became known as Seward's, quote, "irrepressible conflict speech." Because Seward in that speech said that he believed that the slave system was, quote, "intolerable, unjust, and inhuman." He also indicated that having slave states and free states was incompatible, and that, quote, it's an irrepressible conflict between opposing and enduring forces, and it means that the United States must and will sooner or later become either entirely a slaveholding nation or entirely a free labor nation, unquote. And he insisted that a decision must be made about slave states and free states, quote, "even at the cost of civil war." So he was throwing down the gauntlet. He was basically drawing the line in the sand and saying, "America, enough is enough." 1858, it was 3 years before the start of the Civil War. He was saying, there's a conflict here, and we either go full throttle into slavery or full throttle out of slavery, and we're going to have to fight it out, because this state of schizophrenia has to stop. We cannot continue like this. And so this is the kind of man William Seward was. And I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing his surname correctly, but bear with me if that's not the correct pronunciation. I didn't get a chance to ask him how he wanted it pronounced. So the thing is that William Seward was this strongly anti-slavery person, participating in the Underground Railroad to help fugitive slaves escape from the South into the North, and so forth. So it's puzzling to me what the hell happened that prompted him to support the Corwin Amendment. It's as if he saw the line in the sand and he got scared. The very line he drew in 1858... it's as if he said, "No, we can't go there. It's too much." Something broke in him. And it's believed, many historians actually believe, that Lincoln had conversations with Seward. Because all this secession stuff happened after Lincoln was elected in November. Because in American politics, for reasons that I still don't quite understand, we have this lame duck period between November and the inauguration, which used to be in March in the old days, and then now it's in January. But during that interim, you know, we have this period of transition, the lame duck presidency period. And it was during that period that the South, southern states began to secede, 7 out of the 11 states that eventually formed the Confederate States of America seceded before Lincoln even took office in the White House. But they did so because Lincoln had been elected, and they saw in Lincoln a monster, the monster to them that he really wasn't. And how do I know that? Well, how do we know that? Just listen to him in his inauguration. And listen to his actions after he was elected and went into office, and his actions at the start of the Civil War, during the Civil War, and towards the end of the Civil War, and after the Civil War ended. It was this consistent attitude and behavior throughout. He was not that type of monster, but something got into the souls of the South. It kind of reminds me of this story in the Bible, and I might be totally trashing the details of it because I don't have too good of a memory when it comes to such details. But there's a story in the Bible that there was this army, I think it was a Syrian army, that was coming, a huge army coming against Israel. And there was this king who gathered his much smaller army and went out to fight this oncoming invasion. And they were on these, and I might be kind of completely distorting the story, but hopefully you won't mind too much. The important thing is the gist of what I'm trying to say. I think they kind of I think the army was in a sort of valley. So the king, and I think it was Jehoshaphat or someone like that, gathered the small, much smaller army, and they were on this high area overlooking the valley, you could say, and they didn't know what to do. And then it occurred to them after praying that they needed to make a lot of noise or something like that. And so they started banging stuff and sounding the shofar or whatever, and making all this incredible noise. And apparently the strategy became to make it sound like this roaring army of Israelites was coming into the valley to massacre this huge Syrian army. And when the army down below in the valley heard this massive sound, this massive music and all this coming from above, they panicked, and they started kind of running frantically, and they were in such a state of panic that they started fighting against each other, because they were running against each other, you know, and all that panic of all these people huddled together in this valley, you had someone coming with a sword at you, and you didn't know if this guy that was coming at you was an Israelite coming at you or some other Syrian guy. You didn't have time to ask him, hey man, are you one of us? What's up with you? You know, so they started kind of killing each other off. And apparently they, according to the Bible, 185,000 Syrians died that day, all killing each other. And basically, in a sense, that's what happened to the South. The South saw a monster coming that wasn't really there. Because it's as if Lincoln was given a persona over him that even he was not aware of, that stood in front of him. And every time the South saw him, they saw this persona that was placed over him. And that it's as if they said, the hell with you. We are going to do whatever the hell we want. And that persona was the persona of the truth. Coming to judge them and destroy their institution and the South raised its fist at God and everyone on earth, saying, "The hell you're going to take our slaves from our hands. You will have to kill us first." That's how arrogant and defiant the South was. And if you're a conservative Christian, and especially if you're in the South, you should be aware of and understand what the South was doing. If your God is real, if the God you believe in is the real deal, the South was effectively raising its fist at God and saying, "The hell with you," and saying obscenities that I cannot possibly ever say verbal with my mouth. At God, that's what the South was doing. "The hell with you, God. We're going to do whatever the hell we want. Come and get us if you can." And if you're a conservative Christian, I can tell you, your God said, the hell you're getting away with this, I'm coming at you." And the reason why this happened, I would dare say, and if you're a conservative Christian, this is what you have to understand, is that there were prayers of people, of many people, on their knees praying day and night for the end of slavery in this country. Day and night, day and night. And the politicians and everybody didn't do a damn thing to change the situation. But there were these people praying day and night, praying day and night, praying day and night. And it stirred something to the point that that it's as if supernaturally something happened that led to this country reaching this valley of decision and forcing it to do what it never wanted to do. But it was the result of all this force of all these people willing it into being. And it happened even against Lincoln's wish, because if Lincoln had had his way, slavery would still be around today. And the thing is that so that this is the Lincoln that took off from his day of inauguration. He was compromised already. And many historians believe that Lincoln was aware of what was going on in Congress, with this amendment being passed, and that he, behind the scenes, was actively participating. And many believe that Lincoln and Seward were having conversations, and that let me add what I would think about when I think about this. I think Lincoln actually talked to Seward, saying, "Hey, I'm against slavery too, man. You know, I know you don't like slavery. I don't like slavery one bit. You've heard my speeches. You've heard my Lincoln Douglas debate speeches. You have the transcripts. And if you don't, it's $9.95 for the whole set, plus tax. And I can give them to you if you want to read them and confirm that I am against slavery. But you know, man, you know what happened here. The states have seceded. The seven states, our union, our beautiful union that God has created and put on earth as a beacon of life and liberty for the whole world to see, this beautiful nation is falling apart. And we can't let that happen. We are the light of the world here. We are the beacon of freedom and a new life that God has put on earth so that we can show what can happen when a nation is living under these wonderful principles of God, our creator. And we can't let that dream die, can we, Billy Boy? No, we can't, can we? I'm not pro-slavery, man, but we have to rescue the nation. We have to rescue the nation that God gave birth to. And if we let that nation die, that democracy dies, the principles of freedom and individual rights die. Now, I can only imagine what sort of talk he gave him, all full of contradiction. Because if this nation is so important to preserve because it's a beacon of freedom, then to preserve the beacon of freedom, we have to continue upholding the slavery and the dis- and the utter humiliation of an entire race of people. And it's like we never seem to deal with that contradiction. And the thing is that he must have been talking to Seward, and he must have broken down his will, or something happened to Seward, or a combination of both, Lincoln talking to him and him having some sort of episode where Seward eventually said, okay, yeah, I think we have to save the nation from itself, and therefore we will pass the Corwin Amendment. But I do believe that Lincoln had a lot to do with convincing Seward into doing this. It's almost, this is almost like a Jew voting for the Nazi Party. That's to the level of how contradictory it is for William Seward to have supported this amendment, the Corwin Amendment that never passed. And just to give you another taste of what Lincoln was about, there was this editor, Horace Greeley, and I pass by the park that's named in his honor every week. I go to New York as well. I go past the Seward statue almost every week. Sometimes I take a different route. And always, every single time I pass through this park that's named after, it's a small park named after Horace Greeley in New York, because that's where the train station is, where I take the train to come back to Hoboken from New York. And this guy was apparently the editor of a newspaper called the New York Tribune, and he was a very well-known figure in American journalism and politics, you could say. And this guy was also a staunch anti-slavery person, and he was very critical of politicians for not really moving forward to take steps to end slavery. He also was frustrated by the shuffling of feet, you know, that slowness, people just acting like they're moving but never really moving. And he was critical of Lincoln because of that, because he saw that in Lincoln. So this guy saw it in Lincoln back in the 1860s. We're not rewriting history. That's exactly what Lincoln was. And so he would begin to pound Lincoln in his editorials, and then Lincoln kind of upset at the negative publicity that this guy was generating for him, because Lincoln was always concerned about his legacy and how people viewed him. He was always concerned about that. He was always wondering, what do people think of me? A little bit like Nixon. He had a touch of Nixon in him. Nixon was like that too. Nixon was constantly obsessed with, do people like me? What do people think of me? And that was part of what led to his downfall, that constant obsession. So Lincoln was concerned about Horace Greeley's criticism, and he wrote a letter to him dated August 22nd, 1862. And in that letter, he wrote the following. And I'm going to read exactly what he wrote in the letter. He wrote, quote, "My paramount object in this struggle," and he said in this struggle because we were at war, in the full throes of war. It's August 1862. It's going on one and a half years of war, or of civil war. And he said, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. And it's not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do it because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union." And then he wrote, "I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free." Unquote. So you see how he's talking gibberish, talking this, talking that, and then at the end saying the complete opposite of what he just said. And you could say, no, I know exactly what he said. He said that the limitations of his office are, or his oath is to preserve the union, and his personal views are completely different. But as an official, he is not interested in promoting his personal views. His oath to the office is what matters here, and he is here to preserve the country that he was elected to represent in the White House. And you can spin it all day long, but it's like saying, you know, if I want to preserve, imagine someone saying, I want to preserve the nation of Germany. And if that means that I have to kill all the Jews so that we can save Germany, I shall do that. And if it means freeing all the Jews from the concentration camps to save Germany, I will do that. Now, I know you know that in my personal life, I have voiced my strong objection to the Jews being put in the gas chambers and murdered en masse like that by the millions. You know my personal opposition to that. But as president, my job is to preserve Germany. And if I have to kill all the Jews to do it, or save all the Jews to do it, or kill some and save some to do it, I will do it. But because my oath to the office was to do what needed to be done for the best, for what was best for the country. Imagine someone saying that. You'd go, what the hell is wrong with that guy? What the hell is wrong with him? Because I can understand the vacillation, and I say that understand in quotes. I can understand the vacillation in someone who has no conviction about the issue. But if you know deep within you that something is fundamentally wrong, that everything else should stop mattering. You shouldn't go, no, but, what can I do? I do understand that there are certain things where there's a scope of limitation that I do understand. If you believe that abortion is wrong and you are the cashier at McDonald's and you're taking an order from a couple of people that are talking about how important abortion is, and we're going to go protest the Roe v. Wade overturn decision, whatever. You're not going to say, oh, I am against you. I will not serve you a Big Mac because you are abortionists. No, because in that scope, the person's job is to serve hamburgers, to take the order, ring it up and put it into the system so that they can get their hamburgers and get the hell out of there. That's his or her job. It's not their place to get into a political argument with the customers there. So there's a scope of limitation. I understand that. But we're not talking about serving hamburgers. We're not talking about someone who is providing some sort of general service. We're talking about someone who is serving in a position of government. And government is the exercise of authority. And authority is the truth. And from the truth emanate rights. And the government is supposed to enforce the truth, enforce the rights, and protect the rights, and attack those who violate those rights. That's exactly the duty of it. And it goes beyond the boundaries of whatever the Constitution or any document on earth could define, force you to do. I understand if you're within a limited system, a crappy system like the one we have, you kind of have to kind of play within the boundaries. But there comes a point where you go, if I can take this whole thing, I will take it. If you can expand your area of scope, and because it has to be done, there's no other choice, you have to do it. While at the same time saying, hey, we have to change the playbook because there's something very wrong with this. But you have to. There's a higher law. Just like Seward said, there's a higher law. And you cannot, you're in a position of government. It's related very deeply to the truth. Your core morality, your core values are embedded in it. It's not like serving hamburgers or writing software or providing a channel, like for example, Twitter and all these other media out internet media mechanisms that are there just to provide a channel of communication. They're not there to be telling you who, what you think, what to think, what not to think. They're injecting themselves into that. It's like the lady at the cashier at McDonald's. If you know, assuming she's a Democrat, saying, I'm not going to serve you a Big Mac because I overheard your conversation and you are Trump supporters, or I can see your MAGA hats and I'm not going to serve you. You know, that's exactly the same thing. But we're not talking about services that are kind of completely separate. We're talking about someone who is in a position of government, of authority. And authority is to uphold the truth. And the truth comes from the five rights that are... that stand above any human document or institution. And the time had come. He was at a point where he was given the carte blanche to by history, saying, okay, man, the current constitutional system is limited, and it has bound this nation, and it's falling apart now, man. Now it's time for you to stretch your domain and make it happen, because the current system will not let you let you do it. It's the same thing what happened on January 6th, 2021. You know, in the U.S. with the whole protest thing in Washington D.C. when people when the 2020 election was being the result was being made official that day. With the Electoral College count and all that, you know the story. Miguelito Pence, and that's how I call him, this bastard little conservative Christian whore, Miguelito Pence, had the option as the vice president to say, I don't ratify this election. There's a lot of inconsistencies, a lot of weird stuff going on. We have to re-examine the election and see what in the world happened here, because clearly something is not kosher here. And he could have said, and then all hell would have broken loose that day as a result. And he would have gotten a lot of hatred from the, you know, the liberal, white, fascist controlled media and so forth. You could say that maybe in a certain sense the Constitution really didn't empower him, because that's what he kept saying. The Constitution does not empower me to decide on election fraud. It only tells me that I can ratify the votes according to what the state said. If the state said that they have ratified these electoral electors, then, and I look at the documents and it looks all okay, signed by, you know, the governor of the state and so forth, then I can say, okay, the states have sent these guys. I have no choice but to accept these guys' votes are as legitimate as per the Constitution. And that's the stance he took. And it sounds so noble, but that's it's exactly what Lincoln was trying to do the whole time. And it's as if his maker said, the hell you're going to do that, sonny boy. I'm going to make you go through hell in this country, go through hell until my will is done. And because of that, we had to go beyond the Constitution, break it, and then eventually that's how slavery ended. And then the 13th Amendment was added. And we'll talk about the 13th Amendment later and all that, but for now, we're talking about this... this attitude that people have, that they live by this, the limitation of a broken constitution, a broken system, and are unwilling to break away from it or like expand from that bondage that the Constitution was placing on them to do what had to be done. the Constitution is very iffy about it, but he could have expanded it to say, yes, I am here for, as I have a certain authority to legitimize the voting today, and I am going to take a stand. And it may look like I'm doing it because I want to stay in the White House, and it may look like I am doing it because of personal convenience, and that I'm a sore loser and don't want to accept that I lost. It may look like it, but I don't care. I have to do what's right. The principle of electoral integrity has been violated, and it goes way beyond any technicality that I can hide myself behind to avoid dealing with this issue. And the problem is the Constitution is so stupidly written, as we've gone over so many times, that it has created the system where the states can do their shenanigans and no one can do anything about it. It is written the states can decide their own laws, voting laws, even for federal laws, for federal elections that affect other states. You know, because when they send certain representatives to vote on national bills, their votes, their local state votes affect what happens in the rest of the country from a legal standpoint. From a judicial standpoint, appointments of Supreme Court justices, all these things get affected. So it's not like, every state decides their own fate. No, they're deciding the other state's fates by the laws that they write about how they run elections. And the federal government has little power to question it. There is no mechanism. What happened if there's a contested election? What do we do? There's nothing in the system for that. That's how bad it is. That's why you have to stretch in a certain pivotal moment in history. There are times when you have to do that because the system is broken, and you have to admit it. It's broken. And Blinken was one of those guys who wanted to go by the system and just go by the book. And so that's why he wrote what he wrote to Horace Greeley in 1862, 1.5 years into the war. And this son of a bitch is still holding on to his stupid understanding. It's like he was waiting for something magical to happen to magically end, the war and have the Union restored. He didn't care if not a single slave was saved in the process. If I had been there, I would have said, okay, we're taking this all the way, man. It's either all or nothing here. I don't care about my legacy. I've been put in this position. The hell with you, the South. We're gonna beat your butt and pummel you to the ground and kick you and stomp on you until you surrender and let those black people go. Simple as that. And we're not gonna let up until you sons of bitches surrender. And we're going to punish you and torture you and pound on you until you are done. I don't care about the Constitution. I don't care about anything. It's your time to die, you son of a bitch. That's the attitude I would have taken. And I would have kind of put a diplomatic tone to it. But that's what I would have been thinking on the inside. And that's how I would have been acting on the inside. And then maybe, who knows, I don't think I might have taken too much of a diplomatic tone on that. But that's exactly what you need to do to resolve these types of things when you're put in the historical moment to do them. So I hope that you're getting a better sense of what Lincoln was about. And let's talk about the Emancipation Proclamation a little bit. We were going to be able to say a lot more things, but we're coming close to the end. Let's just talk very quickly about the Emancipation Proclamation. As we've said before, Lincoln's solution to the slavery problem was to ship all the blacks to Africa. That was his his final solution to it. In other words, to him, it was almost as if slavery was a mistake from the beginning and that black people should have never been here to begin with. So the best solution is to kind of undo that and send them all back to where they should have been and should have stayed in the first place. And as we've said before, that's the correct attitude as well. Because slavery had to happen. Black people had to be punished and enslaved for a period because of what they kept doing in Africa. It was like a jail sentence. The slavery was a jail sentence, but this jail sentence or the prison sentence had a time limit to it. It was not forever and ever. It was until they paid their debt. And once the debt was paid, there was no reason to keep them in prison, in the prison of slavery anymore. And it was time to let them go. So that they could have a brand new start. It's as if a remnant of them were dragged against their will from all the cannibalism, and I mean virtual and sometimes literal cannibalism that was going on, them destroying each other, eating each other up in Africa, and being brought here to fulfill their destiny, because black people are, as we said before, visionaries and conquerors. That is their two predominant traits. And as visionaries, their calling is to sacrifice themselves for others. That's one of the things that a visionary is like born to do. They feel this natural inclination to die and sacrifice for the sake of others. And it's as if they swallowed that and they were visionary to flow in the visionary to satisfy themselves, but never to die for their fellow man. So because of that, they were sentenced to sacrifice against their will for others. And what happened is the black people who came to America and suffered these generations of slaves, they prepared the way for the future generations that would be born into freedom and have an opportunity to grow up in the land of opportunity and have the opportunities that they would have never dreamed of having back in Africa. You know, black people in America have it great. They complain about all the stuff and police brutality and all that nonsense, but a lot of it is self-inflicted. Most of it is self-inflicted nowadays. Back in, you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s, yes, obviously it was a lot of racism and oppression, but now it's just for the most part self-inflicted. But even within that self-destruction that they do, the same self-destruction that they were supposed to get away from in Africa, they're doing it now here. But even in the midst of that, a lot of them have an opportunity to flourish and prosper and have opportunities, financial and otherwise, that they would have never had back in Africa. Would Michael Jordan have ever made something of himself if he had been born back in Africa? If his ancestors had stayed in Africa and he had been born somewhere in Ghana or who knows where? Do you think we would even know who he is or he was? No, there's no chance in hell we would have known who he was. Do you think Michael Jackson would have become the world famous person that he became had his ancestors not been dragged from Africa to America? No, there's no way. And all this person after person, Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder, and all these people who have made something of themselves and succeeded in ways unimaginable, they were able to do it because they were born in America. And they've had these opportunities that they have never had before because their ancestors paid the sacrifice against their will, but they paid it. It's as if they were set. It was said to them, "Oh, you're not going to be a visionary sacrificing for others. I'm going to make you sacrifice for your future generations, whether you like it or not, because you need to fulfill your destiny." So there was a punishment there, and Lincoln never understood that. Lincoln was an idiot. And most people are idiots, and conservatives are idiots also. They don't understand that. Liberals don't understand that either. So there's it's weird because there's a mixed reality to it that slavery was right for a time or needed for a time, and then it wasn't. And so there's a certain dichotomy there in the reality of slavery metaphysically. But it's ironic that we kind of lived out the dichotomy in the natural realm where we are both acting like slavery was bad and slavery was good at the same time. Because if slavery was completely bad and should have never happened, then we should find a way to send all blacks back to Africa. I mean, you can't have it both ways. Either they should be here or shouldn't be here. Or if slavery was a completely good thing, a noble thing, a moral thing, and will always be a moral thing, then we should try to enslave black people again. But, you know, it's an either-or situation. But the reality is mixed. We just don't seem to see it. And let me just end. There was a lot more to say, but let me end with this small incident, you could say, that I witnessed this week. On my lunch break, I went to the pier here in Hoboken, Pier A. I always go there. I sat down, with a beverage that I buy, and I went and sat down in one of the benches there. It was a hot day, and I was carrying my beverage, going towards the bench. And let me just describe what I saw. It's as if I looked, and there were a whole bunch of black kids on one side. And then I turned around and looked to the other side, and a whole bunch of black kids on the other side. And it just completely took me by surprise. Like, why are all of these black kids here? And you may say, oh, you're a racist. No, what I'm saying is it's not a common thing, because Hoboken does not have a high population of black people. You don't see a lot of black people all the time. It's not like you're living, in some parts of Brooklyn where everybody seems to be black, or in the Bronx, or Harlem, or some place like that. Yeah, there are black people. It's not that common, but I had never seen so many black people at once in that pier, and especially kids, so many black kids. And I said, what's going on? And there were some adults with them, black adults. And the kids were, all over the place. And I said, I was just curious what was going on. So I went and sat down. And when I sat down on the bench, I was facing this big lawn area, rectangular area, and looking out towards the Hudson River and Manhattan on the other side, the skyline of Manhattan. And the kids started playing on the lawn, the black kids. And I started looking at them, and I saw them running around on the lawn, playing and doing their thing. And the kids range from the ages of maybe 6 or 7 or 8 to like 16. The range was all over the place. And the kids were playing and doing their things, and some of them had like a football. They were throwing it around and stuff like that. An American football, not the soccer or round football. It's the other one. As I saw them playing, I will tell you honestly, I'm not saying this just to say it. This is exactly what I felt on the inside. I felt joy in my heart, saying, these kids would be playing in some dry, godforsaken field in Uganda somewhere if their ancestors had not paid the price. But their ancestors paid the price against their will. But they paid the price, came as slaves, and now these kids are here. Now they're free, and they're playing around in Hoboken in this beautiful lawn on this beautiful but hot summer day, and right next to the greatest city, or it used to be the greatest city in America. Well, it might still be the greatest city. It's just that the whole country's going to hell, so saying that doesn't really say much about the city anyway. But the thing is that they have this opportunity, and they're living in the wealthiest country on earth, in terms of opportunities and mass resources and all this, and I felt happy for them. But the thing that drew my attention is, I've seen kids play there a lot, sometimes like soccer or football, little clubs go to that place to and bring their The little kids, you know, the tiny little things that come and they start training them in playing football or soccer, as it's called here in the US. And it's kind of cute to watch them. So I've observed young kids there playing and stuff, and I like to observe them and kind of see their faces and their personalities and all that. And I was watching these black kids, and I found it amazing how much more athletic they are than when I would watch white kids or Hispanic kids play. It's like, my goodness, some of them were doing backflips, and you could see them when they were running to, you know, throwing the football at each other. You could see that it's as if these kids were born with the genetics to be athletes. It's like almost like I was watching adults running a passing route, an American football passing route, and how they threw the ball and the instinct. It's that, my goodness, these kids are gifted. It's like they are given a gift from the creator to do these things. And just naturally, there were some young girls that were doing these backflips. And like, my goodness, it's like it's in them. They're gazelles, you know, just like watching gazelles that, you know, are running around and jumping up and down, doing all these athletic feats. It was like a wonderful thing to behold. And then I began to notice that some of them were playing, and one of them would fall to the ground. It's like they were kind of like, it almost looked like they were play fighting, but it was kind of play fighting, but it wasn't. And one of them would fall to the ground, the grass, on the grass, and the others would start kicking him while he was on the ground. Like kicking someone when they're down, literally. And punching the kid while he was on the ground. And then they would stop, and the kid would kind of get up. And then it would happen again a little later with another kid. And I said, what? And I'm, pardon my French, but I was saying, what the hell is this? You know, because I've seen kids play, but I've never seen white kids do that. Not even Hispanics. Hispanics tend to do that to animals. They tend to harass animals. They love to chase after animals, but not in a playful way. You can see the evil in their faces, the Hispanic kids. It's always evil. How they harass the geese and the little birds or seagulls that sometimes are on the pier. So I've seen different levels of things, but I had never seen that. And then it kept happening. And I said, where do they get that to start kicking someone, throwing them to the ground and kicking them while they're on the ground? That doesn't sound natural, especially from kids. And then as time progressed, I kept observing. And then suddenly, two kids, I think one was short, and I think his name was my name. And I found out because of what happened later, but the kid was like 7 or 8. And apparently he got into some sort of argument, or there's something going on with another kid who was about maybe 9 or 10. The shorter kid was in red, and the taller kid was in blue. So it was kind of interesting because, you know, red is the color of the Republican Party here, or conservatives, and blue is the color of Democrats or liberals. So the red kid and the blue kid started fighting with each other, and it started getting really serious. And to the point that at some point, one of them started sneaking up behind the other one and started punching him from behind. And then the other one would turn around, and they were not just playing, they were really punching each other. And then the other kids would start to separate them a bit, and they were still like going at it. And then they would calm down a bit, and the other kids would let them go. And then the other kid that had been sneaked up on would sneak up behind the other one and try to punch him again from behind. And the other ones would react. And then they would get into another skirmish, and it was really getting angry. And the other kids were trying to stop them, but they were and they weren't. It was not, they were not angry at the kids. And there were older kids around, but they were not, you know, say, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? It was like just trying to control it a bit and then letting them go. And they just kept going at it. And then I looked all the way to the other side, the adults were not even, they were like 60 yards away on the other side of the pier, you could say almost. But I could see them and I could see the commotion, and they never did anything about it until it got to the point that finally he paid attention. And I turned around to the guy. He was looking kind of in my direction and the direction of the kids. And I made a gesture at him, like with my hands, shrugging my shoulders, like, what the hell? Look, and pointing at the kids, like, look at what your kids are doing. And I feel sadness that I did not get up at that moment and shout, literally. And I would have done it under other circumstances, but maybe it was the heat, I don't know. Or I was just stunned at what I was observing, that I didn't react. But if I had a little bit of sense about me that moment, I would have literally stood up and said, hey, adult, someone look at what these kids are doing. They're punching each other. Why aren't you doing something about it? What the hell is wrong with these kids? And what is the testimony that you're giving? And I would have shamed them. And I would have pointed at the kids. And who knows, maybe the kids would have come at me as if to say, who the hell are you telling us what to do? Who knows what would have happened? I don't know. But the guy started saying, hey, and he started calling out the kid, the shorter kid in red, who had my name. So it was kind of weird. The tall guy, 6'3", 6'4", shouting at the kids from a distance, never going to the place where they were fighting. I mean, that's what an adult would do. And then a black guy showed up, walking from the opposite side, walked past me, past the bench where I was, and he was on the phone or something, complaining that it's not my problem. I couldn't quite make out the full context, but it seemed like he was complaining that handling these kids is not his responsibility. Almost like he was almost saying, like, I'm just a driver or something like that. And he walked past the kids who were fighting and didn't do a damn thing. It kept going towards the other adult. It's like, what the hell is this? And then I realized, you know, the cannibalism, the destroying each other. It was so creepy to watch one of the kids sneaking up behind the other, like pretending like he was not fighting anymore and just waiting for things to calm down, waiting for the other kid to turn his back so that he could then hit him from behind. And the other kid was also kind of cautious, like looking over his shoulders, is he coming at me again? And then when he would see that he was coming at him, he would turn around and then, you know, they would start exchanging punches. It's like, these are 7 or 8 or 9 year old kids. And where is that coming from? And that's when I saw all that I've been saying about black people. It's not my imagination. I was seeing it playing out. I had never seen that. I've visited that pier over a period of 8 years, all the years I've been in Hoboken. I had never seen kids fighting, ever. And I had to wait until a whole bunch of black kids showed up to see that sort of behavior. And I said, oh my goodness, what was all the sacrifice for that the ancestors made? And I don't know if I had a chance to kind of think it out a bit that day, I would have stood up and really shouted at the adults for not supervising the kids. And I would have shouted at the kids and say, what the hell is wrong with you doing this to each other? What was the point of your ancestors paying the sacrifice of slavery for you to do this? And who knows, all hell would have broken loose. Maybe the adults would have come to punch me out. Who knows? For having said that. And if they had come, then there would have been an exchange of punches. And someone would have died that day, possibly the other guy. Because I would not have let it... I'm just sick and tired. I am just sick and tired of this whole thing. I'm sick and tired of America. I'm sick and tired of the whole thing. But the point is that these kids were given an opportunity and they're not living it out. Black lives do not matter because they do not matter to each other. Black lives do not matter to each other. They don't care about each other. The adults couldn't care less about the kids. So we go back to the very reason why they were dragged into slavery, because they never cared about their fellow man. They are always acting like Cain, asking, am I my brother's keeper? And I say brother literally, you know, in their case, you know, I ain't my brother's keeper. You know, that's their attitude. I'm not going to care for my brother. You know, my brother has his problems. I have my problems. And that's just the way it is. And if he gets in my way, I'm going to get him. And if I get in his way, he's going to get me. And that's how they live. So the visionary thing gone again. And they're conquering each other, cannibalizing each other. And how the hell are they going to prosper as a people? There's no way. There's no way. So we'll end it here. So even though we have been beating up on Lincoln, sadly enough, there's a lot to say about the people that he unwillingly helped to liberate, because they are not living out the freedom that they have been given. So thank you very much for listening. We'll continue talking about Lincoln and hopefully go past Lincoln and into Reconstruction next time. Thank you very much.